You're listening to the Mining and Energy Union podcast.
Yes, indeed you are. I'm Tim Brunero. Well, Tom Mann was the Taylor Swift of unionists. He toured the world getting involved in union blues, like in Broken Hill, where he was arrested helping miners in their fight against BHP. He really was a rock star. In Australia 100 years ago, he was a household name. He was also a coal miner, a teetotaler who ran a pub for a while, a vegetarian who ran a chicken farm. In fact, he was a fruitarian for a little while. He spoke four languages and he had eight kids. Phil Katz has written a book about this legend. He joins me. How are you, Phil?
I'm good, thanks, Tim. Thanks very much for inviting me on.
Mate, we're sitting in the HQ of the Miners Union here in Australia, but you've known a few coal miners in your time. You're involved in the big strikes against Thatcher in 84, 85.
What we've got is an attempt to substitute the rule of the mob for the rule of law.
Indeed, I'm that kind of generation that came to the knowledge that really discovered what the world was about through that coal miners' strike in 84, 85. I was an inner city boy, a printer, who, like many thousands of others, joined miners' support group to help keep the coal mining strike alive.
Fighting for the miners' jobs, tarrah, tarrah. We'll make it down, we'll all
It was a massive strike, almost, what, the biggest in history? Certainly biggest in...
It was our biggest in our history.
In Britain's history, yep. 11,000 miners arrested all told. I think you were arrested a couple of times yourself.
I was had two spells in the cells. I don't recommend it to anybody.
And you also raised a lot of money because, of course, people forget that when you go on strike, you don't get paid. You don't get paid to go on strike. So people didn't have food on the table, but you made sure they did.
People ask me about the miners' strike, and I always say that one of the biggest factors in the strike actually happened a few years before the strike, when the government changed the rules so that strikers' families couldn't draw benefits. So from the minute you walked out of that pit, you had no money and no guarantee of food. I was a young printer, like I say, and an officer of the London Trades Council. I went to Moscow fundraising, to the German Democratic Republic, and actually was involved in putting 40,000 turkeys on Christmas dinner tables for miners in Yorkshire and Kent. So they were important days. And when Arthur Scargill first said that the plan of the government was to close 70 pits and 70,000 jobs, Margaret Thatcher said he was a liar. But within 5 years, there wasn't a single pit and a single coal miner left in the country. And Britain is poorer for that.
If we've got to stop out, well, November or December, we'll beat this coal miner.
Yeah! Incredible history. Look, speaking of history, you've written a book about Tom Mann. He spent a lot of time in England, but also in Australia. And I want to talk about his time in Australia. He was here for about, 10 years or so. And I want to talk about his time in Broken Hill, where he was helping miners in one of their big struggles. But can we just start from the start? Because he was a fascinating character and probably by far the most famous unionist of all time, full stop. He became a coal miner at 10 years old.
Yeah, in what has been described as near medieval conditions, dragging sludge out of the pit and keeping some of the ventilation shafts open. So I think it gave him some strong legs, and he had rude health, but it was impressed on him for the rest of his life, the struggle against poverty.
Yes, of course, it really was a different time. He's born in 1856. 10 years later, he's working down the pit as a coal miner. Now, we're talking about a period here where people were working 7 days a week, and some people were working 12 hours a day. That just seems incredible. Like, you could actually do that, physically work 7 days a week, 12 hours a day.
When people say that to me, I also remind them that people didn't live much beyond 50, 55 years old. And I think that's the reason why. When you think of some of their jobs, many of these jobs had no support through machinery. It was a pick and a shovel and a candle and a canary.
He's obviously a big thinker. He's very involved in unionism. In 1889, he gets involved in the dock strikes in London, and you might tell us a bit about that. One thing I will mention, and I'm sure you won't forget this, that there was Australian money flowing from Australian unionists to help those striking workers even back in 1889, which is incredible when you think about it. Tell us a bit what happened there and what he learned, because this is when he was carrying guns around.
Yeah, well, he was carrying guns around, but he was a practicing Christian who at one point was going to take up the cloth. After the pits, he becomes a craftsman engineer, and they were very big on self-education, and he gets involved with a Swedenborg Christian movement, which trains him in reading, in writing, and in public speaking, all things that stood him in good stead for a long time. And then he becomes an organizer in the docks for the unions in 1889, at a time when the docks were really what we call casualized or precarious labor. Most commentators thought that it was impossible to join those people into unions. Tom did that along with Ben Tillett and John Burns, and the rest is history, because that strike changed trade unionism around the world and forever. It also started this extraordinary relationship with Australia and with the trade unionists of Australia. So there were 100,000 dockers on strike. Most didn't know where their next day's meal was going to come from. Most had one shirt and one pair of shoes. And so Tom decided to march this sea of poverty into the city of London to advertise their plight. And it worked. Public opinion shifted strongly in their favour, and that message went round the world. And in Australia, collections were started. It wasn't just trade unionists, it was the church, it was business people. And you may be shocked to find that the London money ran out within 2 weeks. The next 3 weeks of the strike were sustained from Australia, raising the equivalent of £4.8 million in 2 weeks. I was fascinated to work out how news of the strike travelled such long distances and how people paid money in those days, and I've researched that a little bit. And in fact, the trade unions had a bank account in London that the money was passed through to. So that was some £30,000 in 2 weeks was raised. It's an extraordinary figure.
I love you taking us to the scene where he marches all these people through the streets. Can you take us to another scene where he's, you know, walking around with these two guns? Because I believed he used them. They weren't just for show. And he was arrested, I think, on a matter related to them.
Yeah, that's true. Because of his concern with poverty was that he didn't just divide people as strikers and strike breakers. It wasn't that simple. And Tom would often go in amongst the strike breakers, recognising how desperate they were, and to try and talk them onto the side of strikers. By the way, he did it again with great effect at Broken Hill and at Port Pirie during the strikes. At that time, most people had very little money. They were joining the union for the first time. They were paying in pennies, not even pennies, farthings, their union dues. So these guys were carrying a lot of money around. So Tom was armed to protect himself. And there was a court case where two strike breakers claimed that he had used weapons against them, but then admitted that they were being paid to lie. Tom wasn't afraid of violence. I'll say that. That might upset some of your listeners. But he recognized the violence of poverty and the way that employers often colluded with the police to try and break strikes. And he said, you need to use anything at your disposal to stop that, because the most important thing is that the strike wins. And so, for example, he had been heavily involved in the unemployed movement in the 1880s when the British government brought cannons into Trafalgar Square to train them on demonstrators. And Mann was part of the deputation that said to the soldiers there, don't use those, we'll use them because we used to be soldiers yesterday. And again, during the dock strike, the dockers, the striking dockers, were being drilled by officers that had served in the Sudan, because so many of these guys went into the army, came back, worked in the docks or down the pit. So it was kind of part of their life. I've got no account of them being carried in the 20th century. But even later in China when he was involved in armed demonstrations of striking port workers, you find him being prepared to protect himself.
Look, it's a fascinating period. Of course, in 1890, he's elected president of the Dockers Union or the Wharfies or the MUA, we probably call it today. He's about 34 at this stage. Yeah. Not long after, in his early 40s, he decides to come to Australia. Why does he do that?
I think the way that the history is written, that kind of appears like it's dropped out of the sky. But when you look at Tom Mann, it certainly isn't the case. You've got a guy who's got a very big brain, but he understands that the good ideas, that the motivating ideas, come from engagement with ordinary people. And so you find him talking to people all around the world, and he was very close to a whole number of people here in Australia. You find him building organisations that then open branches around the world. The Dockers, he formed the International Transport Workers Federation in 1897. That had very strong affiliation from Melbourne and Sydney and Adelaide. So he knew of Australia. He also realised the fight against poverty wasn't going to be won through just trade unionism. On one hand, he's meeting with this group in London called the Cosmopolitans, who are lecturing about the benefits of life in New Zealand. And at the same time, he hears that in Australia, which he considered was 10 years ahead of the movement in Britain, there are actually Labour governments who are legislating for the eight-hour day, which was his great passion, and who are legislating in favour of arbitration so unions could be recognised, and had a conciliation service, and had the vote, and had education. These were all things that they were earnestly scrapping for in England, but didn't have. And so he kind of reaches a midlife. There's some evidence that he was going to move lock, stock and barrel to Australia. I find that unlikely because he had children in England, even though he had two more in Australia. And I think that by the end, by the time he was leaving Australia, he saw it more as a decade-long education process. So he came, first of all, to New Zealand, then to Sydney shortly, and then into Melbourne, and started looking door-to-door at this dream, asking people, what is your social and economic situation? And found straight away a lot of poverty, a lot of unemployment, and a lot of moving around for jobs.
Of course, it's easy to forget that in this period, Australia and New Zealand are very radical and are much more advanced than other parts of the world. Of course, New Zealand famously the first jurisdiction in the world to give women the vote, although the people in South Australia will quibble with you over that and say, actually, South Australia was first. But our electoral system, our Australian federal government, Commonwealth government system, was much more advanced than the rest of the world. We had Saturday voting, which doesn't sound like very much, but of course, if voting's on a Tuesday or a weekday, working people can't vote. So just having it on a Saturday was a huge advance. We had the secret ballot, which was originally called the Australian ballot, which means you did your voting in private, because in other countries and other jurisdictions, you voted in front of other people, which meant people knew how you voted, which meant you could get bashed when you went round the corner from the polling booth. We had much more enfranchisement in terms of people being able to vote. Many more men could vote than in other countries. We had the Independent Australia Electoral Commission, compulsory voting. So we're much more advanced, even just on that level. As you say, when he arrives in New Zealand, first stop before he comes to Australia, it's a Liberal Labor government, which was very much, as you say, ahead of its time in terms of the world. So I suppose he comes here because he's just pumped that it's so much more advanced than the rest of the world. And it's sort of interesting to contrast that perhaps with where we are now in Australia.
Yeah, absolutely.
So he comes to New Zealand and he is in Victoria. You say that very quickly he becomes an activist for the Labor Party, the Australian Labor Party, and that his impression on ALP just in Victoria in a couple of years is quite measurably incredible. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I would say that the impact is all the more extraordinary when you realise that he was only being paid about £600 for an entire campaign and tour. But between 1900 and 1902, very few Labour Party branches were formed, and most of them were centred on Melbourne itself. There was no organisation outside.
In Bendigo, Ballarat, some of the bigger centres.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And Percy Laidler says that they literally, by horse cart and by horse, travelled thousands of miles through, he says, ice and driving rain. And man would rock up in this small rural hamlet, and he would go into the pub and announce there was going to be a meeting to talk about socialism, and he would get his ladder and he'd stand on his ladder and he'd go around knocking on doors, such that between March and December of 1903, at least 82 new Labour Party branches were formed. And of these, Mann personally initiated 53 of them.
So that's quite incredible that he went round the state, as you say. Whatever he had to do to get there, whether it was by boat or by sled or by, you know, horse and cart, I think later on when he's travelling around, he goes to Kalgoorlie, he's travelling on camels. I mean, he just doesn't let, you know, the tyranny of distance stop him. But just in that period, 54 we can directly trace back to him, 54 branches of the ALP in Victoria, which, of course, some of them are still functioning, which is just incredible when you think about it. It's over 100 years ago.
Laidler says, by the way, that some of his meetings had between 1 and 4,000 people, and not everybody wanted to hear his message, so occasionally he was turfed off of his ladder. The thing, Tim, that really tells the story is what happened to the Labour vote. The state vote rose from 8.6% in 1901 to 27% in 1903. And that was repeated all the way through. It's amazing. I think Tom was following a system that was used in England called the Clarion Movement, which literally on a Saturday and Sunday, they set up Clarion cycle clubs and they'd go out into rural areas propagating the ideals of socialism. He's kind of accepted as the greatest speaker the Labour movement's produced. And he had this way of speaking in language that surprised some people, but also allowed them to listen to socialism without feeling that they were rejecting all of their past life. In one of his speeches, he said, "We declare with Moses and the prophets, with Christ and the early Christians, that there can be no righteousness where land monopoly or machine monopoly obtains, or where the accumulated wealth of private individuals may be used as a means of exploitation." So he's kind of using the language of religion, but he's getting a very modern message across.
He did so much campaigning and touring around on behalf of unions, on behalf of political parties, Queensland, Tasmania. He just travels all over, absolutely prolific. Let's go to Broken Hill, though, because this is where he joins with miners, metalliferous miners, zinc and lead and silver miners in Broken Hill. They're having a big blue with BHP, of course. So, you know, called BHP because it's Broken Hill proprietary, you know, as in BHP. And they had a big blue. I think this is in 1907. And this is a kind of not a union strike in the way we would think of strikes from the 1970s, 80s, 90s. These miners had guns. These miners were on horseback. They were being met by police who were being paid by the company to come up from Adelaide, to come from Sydney, to break the strikes. This could quickly go very wrong, if you know what I mean. Tell us what was going on.
When you think this guy didn't have a smartphone, he didn't have email and he didn't have social media, but he had this ability to keep in touch with people all around the world. And one of his best mates was Big Bill Haywood, who led the West Virginia coal miners. And there was actually a civil war with not just guns, but machine guns and with airplanes dropping phosphorus bombs on striking coal miners going on in West Virginia. So Tom knew once you struck a mine, then it was the gloves came off. And he went to Broken Hill. They paid him £5 travel expenses. He arrived. He donned for the first time a kind of white suit with a large brimmed white hat so that he was immediately recognisable. It was a trick he'd learned from John Burns during the dock strike of 1889. And I think one of the things that Tom said was that when the union took up the interests of a community, that was when it was most powerful. And of course, Broken Hill was a town of 35,000 people when he arrived. In 1881, there'd been no dwellings at all.
Broken Hill, the silver city, awakens to the drums of industry.
So he arrived in a town where BHP owned the water, they owned the transport, they owned everything to do with mining, and the interests of the community depended entirely on the pits. And so Tom, in taking up those cudgels, was taking up the interests of Broken Hill as a whole. And it was a very polarised dispute.
Now, I think the specifics of the dispute was that the company wanted the miners to take a 12.5% pay cut.
Correct.
Which you don't have to really know a lot about the what was going on at the time to know that that might have, you know, met with some objection. He was very disciplined. He had all kinds of tricks. The Tom Man trails, which were the special little tracks that you would use to move around that the company wasn't aware of. They were very good at rooting out spies and stool pigeons because that was a major problem with strikes in the past. He'd learnt that if you had one person in the room who was going to run back to the company and tell them your tactics, then you were, you know, then you may as well not bother. So there was so many lessons that he was bringing from his previous strike experiences.
Yeah, I mean, one of the difficulties of writing about Tom Mann was that he led an agitator's life, and many of his tactics and his plans were never committed to paper, and quite a few of his postcards involved all sorts of code. I'd say one thing, just to scroll back, Mann didn't just accept there were going to be strike breakers. So initially, he not only goes and talks to strike breakers and persuades some to come over to the strike. He builds the union. When it becomes apparent that there are lots of police being brought into the town and more strike breakers on the way, they then blow up the tracks. I don't know whether the union authorised that or not. We'll leave that one
to
history.
It's a very good idea, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It makes for a fairer fight. And then he started to organise, as he'd done in the dock strike, believe it or not, using the same officer that had been in the Sudan, who then was training Dockers pickets in 1889, was in Australia with him, H.H. Champion. And Champion was drilling the miners, which was a way of getting discipline in, and drink was banned, not that anybody could afford it anyway.
I'm told the police enjoyed a few drinks, though.
Yeah, they were stocked up with armaments by the company and plenty of beer.
Interesting. And, of course, these are the police that are coming in on the trains that you need to blow up the tracks to stop.
Yeah, I think that probably he saved a lot of lives by stopping those people coming in. One of the novel things that he did, which is a kind of subplot to the Broken Hill strike, was he helped to organise the women's militia, which had been a feature of previous Broken Hill disputes. But now the women were organised for demonstrations, for running food kitchens, and for acting on the pickets. And so he made shifts out of the picket system, and people would come along to the union office, report at three different times of the day, and they would be drilled, and he would lead them to their picket as a way of keeping them united, keeping them informed about how the dispute was progressing, and keeping them with a kind of sense of purpose and a common sense of values. It was an extraordinary thing. It's really less to do with the coal miners versus BHP. It's more to do with the entire town of Broken Hill against BHP.
Yes, those miners, and of course, you know, the Mining Energy Union still has members in Broken Hill, you know, to this day, and still has, you know, a lot of interest in that town, that community. There are, of course, surviving maps. You talk about how some of his plans weren't written down, but there are surviving maps that he drew to plan where the strikers would be, and you might even call them almost military maps to make sure. I mean, incredibly detailed maps for someone who'd only arrived in the town shortly before to show how to position people so as to block the town. He said, we want to picket the mine so that a rabbit can't even get through. This is to stop strike breakers being brought in by the police or under the protection of the police. An absolutely incredible chapter in Australian industrial history. He is arrested. There's a big confrontation. There's a lot of fighting. And he says the violence is as bad as he's ever seen before. And he's been involved in a lot of strikes. He's arrested and charged with sedition and so on. And then he's told, you can't speak in New South Wales. You've got to leave New South Wales. And he has a very innovative solution to this little problem.
Well, I think Tom was full of innovation. I guess today unions contract social media companies to do that work for them.
All the amateur photographers in Broken Hill were taking photos, and these photos were going around the world. So he was the TikTok star of his day.
He was, and what I'm impressed with is that he didn't arrive at the strike and suddenly think about it. It was part of his schema before he got there. And even when he was banned from New South Wales and had to relocate to South Australia, he was fundraising using PowerPoint projections in his speeches of these photographs. And many of these photographs still exist. And there's a few of them, thanks to colleagues in Australia, who allowed me to reproduce them in the book.
I think we've got a few of them here in the offices of the Mining
and
Energy.
I bet there are. Yeah. So he's using all of the modern techniques. If I can say, I believe the Barrier Truth is still a main newspaper in Broken Hill. That was started by the coal miners, the striking coal miners, so that they had a voice. So there was everything. He was alert to media. He was alert to mobilizing on a family community basis. But he also knew the hard reality of the economics of it. And I think that's why he went to Port Pirie down the road, because Port Pirie and Broken Hill had a strong relationship. The foundries were in Port Pirie, and he went there.
Yeah, they run the ore down a rail, yeah. A purpose-built rail line down to Port Pirie where they smelt it. There's the massive lead smelter down there, isn't there?
That's
the tallest structure in South Australia is still the big chimney, which is part of the smelting process in Port Pirie, like to this day, is in Port Pirie. And, of course, this is the famous, and I'm glad you mentioned, this is the famous pit-to-port organising, which became quite famous. So what did he do down there? And I think you were saying to me, off air, that he was most proud of his organising around Port Pirie, because some of his reforms there were the ones that really did stick for many, many decades.
In honesty, the conditions there were just appalling, with people regularly working 7-day weeks, working 12-hour shifts, breathing in God knows what. And they had no union and they had no real tradition of organising in the way that they did at Broken Hill. So what they achieved down there, bear in mind, the coal miners in Broken Hill then went on to the defensive, and it looked like they might lose the dispute, but the only thing left to Tom was the solidarity of Port Pirie workers, and they stood firm time and time again.
And I think he actually won them the right to work 6 days a week rather than seven, which obviously, you know, having at least a day off.
And they got a pay rise, and they got recognition of the union. So although the Broken Hill dispute ends kind of a little bit messily, in Port Pirie, there were significant and real gains. They're important, by the way. People join a union for a reason. The unions often think they join because they need more money, but a lot of people join because they see a sense of values in the union that they agree with. And I think that Port Pirie brought collectivism and trade unionism to a new community, a very downtrodden community, and it responded well.
I find it so interesting that when he was banned from speaking in South Australia, his solution to that was to go a couple of hours down the road. And I say, I have my tongue in my cheek when I say that, because the little town on the border with South Australia near Broken Hill is a couple of hours away. It's called Cockburn, or Cockburn, it's actually spelt. And I've driven through there on the way up there from Adelaide to Broken Hill. And there's not much there. There's not much there. But a train carrying 4,000 people called the Tom Mann train, with a big picture of him on the front of the steam train, I suppose it was, comes into town. And he talks across the border from South Australia to the people in New South Wales who've come all the way to South Australia to hear him speak. This is during the dispute. So he just had incredibly innovative ways to engage during these strikes, which was just incredible.
Can I just say that what impressed me, I'd like to think that one day we can raise the money to reproduce some of his speeches at Broken Hill. Tom didn't just go to these meetings and say, "Hail fellow, well met. Thanks for sticking together. We're going to win our pay rise." He was lecturing about Tom Paine and the rights of man, about the uprising of the peasants in England under John Bull, who said, "When Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman?" He didn't really hold back at all. He was talking about Robert Owen, and I believe they did open a co-op in Port Pirie. And he called on them. He said, to the men not to be ashamed of the conditions that they were working under. So he kind of said to them, you need to get up off your knees. And if you get up off your knees all at the same time, you'll have a major impact. So I think that what's important is that he brought them together. Secondly, what he said to them, and it was a much bigger message of the hope of a new world, a new society. He was talking about the six-hour day. These were people that were breathing in sulfur and lead fumes throughout their shifts. And to achieve the six-day week will have saved lives again. Soon enough, they were down to five-day week. I think that that's a big achievement in its own right. He had this great respect for people. He had this love of the common man and woman. He saw massive potential in them because he had that potential realized himself. And it was, first of all, Christian socialism and then trade unionism. But then he tried to look for local government reform. And in fact, he was asked by Gladstone, to create a Ministry of Labour and make him the first Secretary of State for Labour whilst still in his early 30s. And he turned that down. And he said, I'd much rather be talking to ordinary people on the stump than I would do making speeches in Parliament where I know nobody's going to listen.
Speaking of his speeches, by the way, you're listening to the Mining and Energy Union podcast. My name's Tim Brunero. Phil Katz is the other voice that you can hear. He's written a book about Tom Mann, the rock star of unionists, probably the most famous international unionist, the Taylor Swift of unionists, who toured around the world about 100 years ago and had an incredible impact on the labour movement, not just here, but all around the world. Are there any recordings of him to still survive speaking?
We're tracking down 2 one-hour tapes that he recorded in 1936. Yeah. We're getting closer. We know who's got them and we're coming for you.
Because I'd love to hear him, because we've talked so much about his powers of oratory and he clearly was a great speaker, but we haven't heard him. And yeah, we know that they could record people because we've seen speeches from that sort of era. Obviously, he would have been late life in the 30s. He would have been in his sort of 70s or whatever, but I just wondered if there was anything still surviving. All right, look, let's move on, because he did so much great work in Broken Hill. Eventually leaves Australia. He's never to come back. He's not allowed to come back. He's not allowed to leave. The Brits won't let him leave. The Australian government won't let him come back. He wasn't able to come back and help the Broken Hill coal miners in their strikes in 1917 and again in 1919 and 1920, which is very sad. But he did love Australia. He wanted to retire here, but again, they wouldn't let him many, many years later. Let's follow his life, though, because he does so much more. He's here for about 7 or 8 years, has an incredible impact. But he goes to South Africa, and I believe that he goes there partly because he can't afford the fare all the way to England.
Yeah, I think he checked out the ship that they'd booked on and said that he didn't think it was seaworthy and wouldn't make the trip fully back. So he decided to cut his losses and go to Durban, where he could do some more lecturing and some more organising and raise the fare to go home. I mean, I think it has to be said that Tom was not unused to rubbing shoulders with Cardinal Manning, the Countess of Warwick, William Gladstone, etc. But when he died, he had about 2 boxes and a bed in his room, and that was it. He had no gain whatsoever. He's gone to South Africa, and it's an interesting twist in his life. So he's kind of had this period in Australia where he was opposed to the White Australia policy, and he's starting to understand what it's like living in a colony, and he starts to incorporate anti-colonialism and anti-imperialism. He's very worried about war. I'm going to shock you now by reading to you the speech that he gave just as he was leaving Australia. He said, "We shall not see another May Day demonstration before the dogs of war are let loose." This is 1910. "It will be war to make capitalistic markets. The battleships are being prepared. Business is meant with dreadnoughts. The airships are in course of construction. The lack of markets is capitalism's extremity. Its war will be socialism's opportunity. The revolution is upon us. They bring war to save their system and do not see it to be the grave of their system." So he is really worried about war. And that's partly why he's heading back to England. And there were a series of clashes with Germany, each time ratcheted up the situation. So he's gone back via South Africa. And en route, he's taken on an organizing job during the general strike in South Africa. And he's focusing on emphysema. It's a campaign amongst coal miners. And part of his research, so that he can write the articles and make the speeches, is to go to a cemetery in Bloemfontein, where, believe it or not, he bumps into the main guy that's working the cemetery, who's from Leeds, who used to listen to Tom Mann speak in the 1890s. And he said to him, "Is this where the white miners are buried?" And he said, "Yeah." He said, "It's pretty bad conditions, isn't it?" And the guy said, "Yeah, but you haven't seen where they bury the black miners. They were in a pit, wrapped in a blanket, by the dozen." And he was shocked. And so anti-colonialism becomes infused with an anti-racism. And he had opposed the white Australia policy. And I think this becomes a feature of his life going on. He comes back to England for a reason, though. He knows there's going to be a major clash in the transport industry. And Ben Tillett, his great lifelong friend, who'd come out to Australia to support him when Mann had been imprisoned in Melbourne in a fight for free speech in 1906, says to him, "Come home, you're the only man that can shake the unions up." And they make an agreement that Tom will come and help lead what turned out to be the sharpest, biggest dispute in British history up until the Great Miners' Strike of the mid-80s.
Now, you're referring here to the big strike on the docks in Liverpool. This is where they basically take over the area. And as you say, Churchill sent 4,000 troops to the area and a couple of gunboats up the Mersey, and a very, very famous maritime area, of course, this area, Liverpool. This is another big formative fight. What happened with that? What did the miners win? Did the strikers win?
I don't think I'd mentioned that during the Broken Hill dispute, the employers set up a union for the strike breakers, and Tom was so persuasive, he brought it into the Central Strike Council. And he did this again on the Merseyside in 1911. The unions that didn't want to conduct a dispute in the docks, he persuaded them to come onto the Central Strike Committee anyway, better to air their views from the inside. And they, in turn, led a major transport strike. So they take over the city, followed by a transport strike. Mann is referred to in Parliament as the dictator of Merseyside by Churchill. Strikers are killed. And it's a dispute that lasts over 70 days. It's a very powerful dispute. He goes from there to Dublin to support the Irish workers in the great lockout strike there, and works with James Connolly, who's a friend and an organiser, and Larkin Sr., who's a friend and an organiser. So wherever there's a problem, Tom is called in.
He pops up. Yeah, no, it's incredible. I should mention, I think the big strikes in Broken Hill he was helping with were actually lockouts. We call them strikes, but of course a lockout is the opposite of a strike. That's when the boss stops people coming to work, as opposed to a strike where people stop going to work. So it's good to make that distinction, and I should have made that myself. It's easy to fall into that trap. Look, I want to talk about the evolution of his ideas in a second, but we are coming towards the end of our podcast today. I just want to quickly give people a sense of how much more travelling he did. He arrives in Australia, I think he's 46 or in his mid-40s. He's here for 10 years. He's now in his mid-50s, but he's not over. He hasn't finished yet. As you mentioned, he goes to Merseyside in Northern England. He goes to Ireland. Just give us a sense, before he kind of retires, how many places he goes to. Can you just run us through? Because
Yeah, I think in 1887 is his first time. He goes to New York, attends the topping out ceremony for the Brooklyn Bridge. And that starts a life of seafaring, which I guess is associated with the docks and being an organizer, and they're not frightened. I also think, for example, he took 47 days to get to Australia, and he had to dock en route various places, including Durban. And this gives you a lot of time to think and a lot of time to write that ordinary people don't get these days. So Tom's gone back to Merseyside. He's then gone to Dublin. He's gone to South Africa for the first time for the general strike. He then does a six-month speaking tour across America for his friend, Big Bill Haywood, and for the industrial syndicalists. Then he comes back to England for the war. And at first, He thinks that it'll be over and done with by Christmas, and the Germans are just reactionary Prussians, so maybe it's a war we just have to get out the way. He very quickly realises that it's a lot more than that, because his friends are coming back wounded, and they ain't coming back by Christmas. And so he becomes a very well-known opponent of the war. Probably one of the two best-known Labour movement opponents. So in 1917, there's a Leeds Convention, and that Leeds Convention brings together the British Labour movement to discuss the Russian Revolution, and they're overwhelmingly in favour, and they don't want to go to war with the Russians. But you asked me about his journeys. They become absolutely incredible. He's in Russia probably eight times during the rest of his life. One point he tours famine-torn Russia with the president, Kalinin, and comes back to England and starts a famine relief movement. He then goes to Moscow and Berlin during the British general strike, just in case the strike leadership is arrested, so that there's somebody abroad who can't be touched who can step in with advice and organisation. He then does a six-month clandestine tour of China to set up a Chinese trade union movement, which involves delegations from Australia, from the Pacific America, from the Philippines and from Indonesia. And then Tom is crisscrossing Ireland, Scandinavia, Canada. And then again, in 1934, he goes to America and they ban him and they won't let him in. And he wants to speak at a meeting of opposition to war, to hunger and war. And there's 15,000 people in a stadium waiting to hear from him. And the unions finally get Secretary of State for Labor to admit him into America. But he misses that meeting. So 2 days later, they do another one. And straight after then, he goes to speak to strike meetings in Pennsylvania. He is absolutely tireless. And even in 1936, at the age of 80, he volunteered to go and fight in Spain.
Under the leadership of General Franco, General Cuerpo de Llano and others, Spain of tradition is rising to repel the Red Invader.
This, of course, is the Spanish Civil War, before World War II. This is Franco being supported by Hitler, who was trying out all his new weapons and so on.
Yeah.
And a lot of socialists go there as part of the international brigades to try and help defeat the fascists.
Well, I think this will interest your listeners and your followers, because he tries to go to Spain and people say, no, you're too old. But in return, he goes on the road speaking in defense of the Spanish Republic, the legitimate government, and then volunteers go to fight in Spain under the banner of the Tom Mann Centuria. And that formed part of the English-speaking British battalion, 2,500 men and many women as well, 500 of whom were killed. But the Australian volunteers for the International Brigades also fought as part of the English-speaking battalion. So they lived and died together, and many of the Australians and the British were unemployed coal miners.
Well, this is what's so amazing is that, as I said at the beginning of our chat, this guy was a household name. I mean, he really was a kind of Taylor Swift character. People knew exactly who he was. And when he turned 80, as you said, in 1936, which is in this period, people celebrated his birthday around the world.
Absolutely. There were two celebrations simultaneous. One was in London and one was in Melbourne. And on his birthday in Melbourne, the civic buildings and the trades hall flew the red flag. The meeting in London has been called the most representative gathering ever of British Labour. On the top table were the Countess of Warwick, who was a well-known philanthropist, Clem Attlee, who was going to become the future Prime Minister.
Labour Prime Minister.
Yeah, he was a great friend of Tom's. And they say it's the only platform ever where the president of the TUC spoke alongside the general secretary of the Communist Party.
So you had people from across the spectrum of the left, so from sort of, I suppose, centre-left all the way through to the sort of the far left, all speaking on the same stage, which is a measure. And that, as you say, that would only happen for that particular occasion, because usually they would be sort of bitter,
They weren't disappointed, enemies. By the way. Tom got up in the middle of it and started singing in Russian and in Chinese. So they probably got their money's worth. And I think that part of the aim was to raise money to get him somewhere to live in retirement, except Tom refused to retire.
He was an incredible character. One question I had, though, and I'll just, this will be my second last question. Why did he never stand for Parliament? I understand that he sort of became a syndicalist and lost faith in political parties and the parliamentary system, and he thought that people who went into them pretty quickly just became swallowed by the system and just chipped away at the edges rather than really pushing reform and so on. But what if he had stood for Parliament? What if he had become Minister for Labour or Secretary for Labour? Could he have done more if he just sort of got inside the tent and had the apparatus of government to start to change some of these things?
I think in 1892, he's the union's representative on the Royal Commission for Labour, which is the most important commission there's ever been into Labour, which helped make unions legal. And Tom proposed the eight-hour day for all local government and state employees and the nationalisation of the docks. He was kind of that far ahead. When the Transport and General Workers Union was formed in 1922... the dock employers cut wages by 10% as a form of punishment. And for the next 20 years, the dockers always asked for the restitution of that 10%, and they never got it by industrial means. When the war started, Ernie Bevin, the great leader of the transport workers, became the Minister for Labour. And the first thing he did was to call in the civil servants and restore the 10% and nationalise the docks and give the dock workers the eight-hour day. That's the power of politics. It wasn't lost on Tom, but I think he took the outside track, and he always felt that he was closer to the people by doing that. And in the long term, there's some evidence that the institutions that he created, some of the biggest unions in Britain today, some of our understanding of what socialism is, those are things that he created that have lasted through the ages. So on the balance sheet, I think he'd be happy, never forgetting that for him, the unions were the basis of the new society. He didn't argue just for 8 hours. He didn't say the working day should be 8 hours. He said that the working day should be 8 hours. People should have 8 hours of rest and 8 hours for the reconstitution of family, community, and society. So the new way of working was where people would get education and go for walks and get their health up and meet their kids and talk to their kids and etc. He thought that was a new world in the making. And I think that's the thread that runs all the way through his life. We're still talking about the eight-hour day now, aren't we?
It's a much more holistic approach, and I think he wanted unions to be the basis of a broader struggle and a total sort of shift in society. Just finally, people can find out more if they want. Of course, the book is called Yours for the Revolution, The Evolution of Tom Mann's Political Thought by Phil Katz. Phil, what can coal miners, of course, Tom Mann was a coal worker and you yourself have stood alongside coal workers, been arrested a couple of times supporting their causes. What can coal workers in 2024 take from his life in terms of their union activism?
The best lesson from Tom is that workers have to do it for themselves. You can trust other people. You can make allies with other political forces. But in the end, you rely on your union and your community, because that's the democratic space where you can have your say, where your views are reflected, where you can take action to improve your lives together. That's the message of Tom Mann. Tom was great mates with Arthur Horner, who also came to Australia. And Arthur and Tom were involved in producing a movement just after he came back from Australia, which was about democratizing the coal miners' union. And many years later, in 1947, Arthur Horner became General Secretary of 1 million strong miners' union.
Coal miners.
And the coal industry was nationalised, and it got the eight-hour day. And that was the power of the union and the legacy and the impact of Tom Mann's friendships. Can I just say one other thing? Tom, in many ways, was as hard as nails, but there wasn't a person, apart from the employers, who would have a bad word to say about him. And I feel that he knew how to disagree without taking out the man or the woman. And I think that's something we want to get back into our movement, where there's less division, less sectarianism, and we come together in pursuit of our common interests. I think that the world would be a better place for that.
Play the ball, not the man. Well, Phil Katz, great to catch up with you on your Australian tour. Of course, you're talking all around the country yourself. You're doing a bit of a Tom Mann yourself. Great to have had a chance to catch up with you on the podcast.
And thanks to you for the opportunity. Fantastic.